Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today's episode is all about U.S. history. But don't expect any pilgrims, the original undocumented immigrants. No, instead, we're going to zoom in on the rich Spanish and Latino history of this country, the narratives you didn't hear about in school. That is, unless your school was Notre Dame University and your professor was Felipe Fernandez Armesto. Felipe is the author of Our America, A Hispanic History of the United States. And he starts our show with a question.
The question you have in mind is one that I put to candidates for a professorship in the colonial period of U.S. history. And the question is, what was the first enduring European colony in what is today U.S. territory? Yeah, easy question. What's the answer?
Well, I guess if I was thinking back on my education, being educated here in the United States, I would probably say it's the British colonies, right?
Yes, excellent. Yes, you should go to the top of the class, Maria, but your teachers should go to the bottom of the class, because that's the answer everybody's taught, and it's wrong.
So the right answer is what?
Well, the right answer's got to be a Spanish colony. The Spaniards were in New Mexico years before there was any permanent English colony in the United States. They were in Florida long before that. Indeed, you know, Spanish has been spoken in what is now the United States for more than 100 years, longer than English has been. It's not a story of immigration. It's a story of, you know, long-standing presence. People in the United States are, well, I wouldn't say perhaps undereducated about their own history, but educated with a certain twist, a certain bias that's distorting and that blots out a big part of the picture.
Most of the time, the narrative when we're learning American history is this whole east to west, right? But there's a whole other way of looking at American history, which is really south to north.
Yeah, I think if you think of the United States as a fabric, you know, like the flag, you've got to have strands going from up and down as well as from side to side. And it's as if, you know, the history of the United States had been written unidimensionally, only going in one direction, the manifest destiny story, this great unrolling, unfolding of the country from sea to shining sea. But, you know, there's a strengthening element, which is the Hispanic colonization, which has proceeded from south to north, and has crisscrossed the Anglo story. And I think one should celebrate that and welcome it.
And that's what today's episode is all about, celebrating the part of U.S. history that takes place in Español. We're going to start our journey in Laredo, Texas, or Laredo, Texas. It's a city packed with history, located on the U.S.-Mexico border.
So we're looking at the border right now.
We're looking at the border right now. I'm trying to get over to the next lane so we're not crossing into Mexico.
That's Blasita López, the head of tourism for Laredo. She took us out for a spin in her white Suburban.
So we're coming into what I call the epicenter of Laredo. Our cathedral here is the major iconic landmark.
I immediately feel like I'm in Mexico. I mean, the hotel is called La Posada, and on my right, we have una plaza, which is like the typical center of town in Mexico, but we're in the United States.
Hints of the city's Hispanic history are everywhere in Laredo. For example, like in the Spanish-style Central Plaza, first laid out in 1755. Or just in talking to people, the history is in their own family stories. Take Blasita, for example, whose family has been in South Texas for centuries.
And at one point the border was north of them, and then the border moved to the river that was south of them, and that's where it stayed. That's the current, you know, U.S.-Mexico border. And so they never moved, but they were Mexicans at one point, and then they were Texans, and then they were Americans.
My family's been here since 1785.
Or Jay Puig.
Yeah, we immigrated from Spain, and when Spain still owned this part of the country, and we immigrated at that time and been here ever since.
Jay says his family has stayed generation after generation because nowhere else feels quite like home.
Where else can you live in the United States and have this kind of culture? I mean, for all practical purposes, people in Mexico say they live in the United States, and people in the United States say they live in Mexico because we live right on the border, you know?
Laredo's culture isn't Mexican or American. It's both at the same time. Strangers greet you interchangeably in English or in Spanish. The shopping malls all have taquerias inside of them. And just scan through the radio dial. But the greatest example of all is the reason we came here in the first place, the annual George Washington birthday celebration. You heard right. George Washington. You probably know by now that Mexicans don't really celebrate Cinco de Mayo. But here on the border, this 96% Latino city, literally a stone's throw from Mexico, hosts the most bombastic celebration of Washington's birthday in the entire country. And it's been going on for 116 years. Every year, for almost the entire month of February, there's galas, parties, social events, parades, and street fairs. But for Laredo's centuries-old upper crust, the main event is the Society of Martha Washington Pageant and Ball. It's a debutante ball where girls from wealthy Mexican-American families dress up like Martha Washington and other wives of America's founding fathers. The girls are known as Las Martas.
You will be overwhelmed. Overwhelmed.
Linda Leindecker Gutierrez is the most in-demand dressmaker for the pageant. She's in her 70s and still tromps around like a pro in 4-inch heels.
This is the Martha from last year, which was my beautiful daughter who works with me.
The green one?
Yes. And it is, the color is of the period. The fabric is of the period of colonial times.
Linda walked us through her showroom in an old Victorian home she owns near downtown.
I mean, honestly, my jaw is dropping because I've never, you know, you see these in las vitrinas of museums, right?
Yeah, I've never seen anything this good in any museum.
She might not be modest, but she's not exaggerating either. Think of the biggest, frilliest, most extravagant dress you can imagine, and then cover it in exquisite glass beadwork. They can weigh up to 100 pounds. Linda's work is highly prized in Laredo.
They call me from the hospital, and I laugh because I go, well, I'm in my 70s, but sure, I'll do it.
You mean they call you after they've given birth to a daughter, and they say,
oh, yes.
We want you to be ready to make my daughter's dress.
Oh, yes. I think it's hilarious.
As you can imagine, the dresses don't come cheap. But how much do they cost?
This is my answer, and it always has been. You see these lips? They are sealed. It's the utmost rudeness to come down to Texas and ask somebody, how many acres do you have or how many wells do you have?
Wells as in oil wells. Many of Laredo's wealthy families got rich from selling drilling rights on their land, land granted to their ancestors by the Spanish kings hundreds of years ago. Meanwhile, at the salon, it's the day of the pageant, and hairdresser Grace Torres is busy defying physics, one colonial-style updo at a time. She gets booked years in advance.
And people reserve themselves like 3 years. Like next year I have 3 to do. The following year I have another 3 more girls.
See, so there's no way I could do a walk-in hair appointment today.
Well, no.
You see, I'm the only one who's going to have the flattest hair tonight.
Sorry about that.
The place is packed with debutantes getting ready for their big moment.
Well, I'm Abigail Adams, and my escort is John Adams.
Actually, that's 17-year-old Karina Alexander. She's playing Abigail tonight. If you ask Karina what this is all about, she'll give you the same answer most Laredoans give. It's a tradition.
All of us have really dreamed about this since we were little girls. I've grown up like watching the pageants like every year, and both my sisters were presented and my mom. So as a little girl, you're like, Mom, I want to do that.
You know, there are people outside of Laredo, when they find out that Laredo has the biggest George Washington birthday celebration, they actually think it's quite strange. What do you say to them?
I honestly don't find it weird. Like, we're in America, we're a part of them just as much as the people over there. Like, just because we're on the border doesn't mean we can't celebrate our first president.
A few hours later, in a massive auditorium, the moment has arrived. Karina is the first to be presented.
The Society of Martha Washington proudly presents their daughters.
Ms. Karina Marie Alexander.
At first, I thought this celebration was odd, a little crusty, a little over the top. But as the days went by, I began to understand it much more. But for the people here, there's no conflict between having Mexican or Spanish origins and celebrating George and Martha. In fact, they complement each other. Take it from Minita Ramirez, president of the Society of Martha Washington.
George Washington, even though he really wanted a private life with Martha, he also understood that he had a responsibility. And when he was called to act, he told her, I have to do this. And so it's about doing the right thing all the time. It's very much a Mexicana or Hispanic value, is that family comes first and you take care of your people and you do the right thing.
Minita says if George and Martha were here today, they'd be pro-Latino.
In our society that we live in today, do I really think that George Washington would say, tú sí y tú no? I don't think so.
For proof, she says, just read the Constitution that Washington helped create.
We thank you for joining us this evening as we celebrate and continue the tradition of linking our past with our present.
We'll revisit Laredo towards the end of our program, but for now, to see pictures of the Jorge y Martha Washingtons of Laredo, Texas, including Congressman Henry Cuellar as George Washington himself, stop by our website, latinousa.org. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So, a little quiz now. What was the first enduring European settlement in the 50 states? Nope, it's not Jamestown. The answer is St. Augustine in Florida. The Spanish arrived there more than 50 years before the Pilgrims even touched Plymouth Rock. They came to protect their sea routes to the Caribbean, and the town they started in 1565 is still there today. But it's changed a bit.
St. Augustine is a combination of history and a pretty happily tacky tourist trap.
That's Warren Miller. He's a reporter who lives near St. Augustine.
In the evening, there are tours with people dressed up in pirate costumes or colonial costumes, literally taking tourists, many of them college students, from bar to bar looking for haunted places.
Now, if you ever want a terrifying colonial-themed pub crawl led by a pirate, well, you know exactly where to go. But there's a lot more to St. Augustine.
The Castillo is one of my favorite places.
That's Carl Halbert, the city's archaeologist.
And he took me out to the Castillo de San Marcos National Monument.
You know, I could come here and just sit and look at the stone and kind of appreciate what the Spanish went through 300 years ago.
The Castillo is a giant fort overlooking St. Augustine, built by the Spanish to fend off pirates and the British between 1672 and 1695.
The first impression that most people get when they look at it is it would be impossible to take this fort.
Meanwhile, downtown in a city park, an archaeological dig is underway.
The premier historian and archaeologist of St. Augustine right now is Dr. Kathleen Deegan.
This has been the most elusive and difficult project I think I've ever worked on. This layer is kind of a gray-brown sandy loam with a lot of oyster shell.
Kathy is looking for remnants of the very first St. Augustine walls to help fill out our picture of what the original Spanish settlement here looked like.
And so this is one of the stains from a wall of 1565. It dips down, it looks kind of like a very large beam.
Kathy's been digging in St. Augustine for almost 40 years. She's already found remains of houses, barracks, and water wells from the Spanish, as well as countless artifacts. She says the biggest takeaway from her work is that the Spanish here had a very different colonial society than the British, who came here shortly after.
And we found in all these sites that Spaniards immediately adopted the food ways, kitchen ways, and a lot of the cultural traits of Native Americans and Africans. And so we find lots of American Indian pottery and objects, even in the governor's house.
This is where the church would have been, right in through here.
That's the city archaeologist Carl Halbert again. He took our reporter to visit another historical site, the mission at the Church of Our Lady of the Rosary.
And buried underneath the floor of that church are roughly about 75 individuals who are of Native American or of mixed blood descent. You know, it really speaks of St. Augustine's mixed cultural heritage.
Not to say that the Spanish weren't at times brutal, but it was a different, a more mestizo kind of colonialism than you typically associate with the United States. Kathy believes that because of the changing demographics of the United States today, the history of St. Augustine will eventually make it into the textbooks, right before the part about the pilgrims at Plymouth Rock.
I think people in America are now ready to accept and learn about a story of multiculturalism and people who were not just English and not just white in the origin of our country.
It's the kind of American origin story that could resonate today. Imagine all those multicolored boys and girls. Imagine if they were learning that the first American colonists looked like them. After Florida, the next site of early Spanish colonization in the U.S. was in the Southwest. The Spanish braved Mexico's northern deserts and crossed the Rio Grande, in many ways, for the same reason Mexican migrants make the trip today. They were in search of riches.
In order to understand the Spanish monarchy in the Americas, you've got to realize that they got lucky early.
Historian Felipe Fernandez Armesto.
They found gold in Hispaniola.
They assumed this would keep happening if they went north.
The next big thing was the discovery of this tremendously rich Aztec world.
The story begins with a black Spanish slave named Esteban de Dorantes. He was shipwrecked on the Texas coast while on a failed mission to explore Florida. Esteban ended up wandering the Southwest for many years. Before he died, he sent back reports about the legendary seven cities of Cibola. Cibola was rumored to be bigger than Tenochtitlan, the conquered Aztec capital, and covered in emeralds.
You know, because there had been a lot of great rich cities discovered in other parts of the Americas, that didn't seem all that weird or implausible.
Back in Mexico City, around the year 1540, would-be conquistadores set off in search of Cibola. They traveled as far as modern-day Kansas. The conquistadores found plenty of indigenous nations, the Pueblo, the Hopi, the Apache, but no emerald cities. Later, visitors stayed and started colonies in the hopes of claiming the vast North American interior for Spain. The first one was named Nuevo México, New Mexico, with its capital at Santa Fe. Okay, now fast forward a few hundred years.
A person will live in a city like San Antonio. He'll drive down a street named Guadalupe. He'll cross a river called Colorado. He'll go to a place called a rancho. He'll sit on a patio next to a corral, and he's going to eat barbacoa. And he's going to say, geez, I don't see the Mexican culture anywhere.
Meet Andres.
I'm Andres Tijerina, professor of history at Austin Community College.
Andres studies Tejano history.
The things we brag about the most in Texas, the things we're most proud, are the most Mexicano. I always say, if it were not for the Tejano, Texas would be Ohio.
The Anglo-Americans who were invited by Mexico to settle in Texas in the 1820s were farming people. But Texas was cattle country. And it was the Tejanos who brought cattle ranching to Texas.
What is more Texan than a cowboy? And that's the culture that Anglo-Americans have completely and so transparently internalized that they don't even see it in themselves.
Andres says the Americans didn't just take culture from the Tejanos. They took their land, their livelihood, and often their lives. In the years after Texas broke off from Mexico, Anglos began to take over the Hispanic-owned ranches.
A typical case, 20 men come on to a Tejano ranch that's been there for 150 years, the Martinez family. The newspaper account the next day says, hordes of Anglos went on to the Martinez Ranch and killed all the Martinez families, and now they live on their lands.
Andres collects these accounts in his work as a historian. Overall, says Andres, thousands of Tejanos were murdered for their land.
When we say ethnic cleansing, we don't want to talk about how the land between Victoria and Corpus Christi was cleansed ethnically, and that those biggest ranches that we brag about today, the big ranches of Texas, many of them don't have a transfer of title.
But this narrative, you don't hear it much in Texas. Instead, you hear about the Mexican army under Santa Anna, slaughtering brave Texan soldiers at the Alamo.
Hi-yip, Santa Anna, we're killing your soldiers below. Let men wherever they go, we'll remember the Alamo.
So the history is inverted, Andres says, and there's a reason for it. Say you're one of the ranchers who benefited from those land seizures.
When your kids go to college at the University of Texas, you don't want them learning about how you got the ranch that made them rich. It is in their vested interest to silence the history.
But little by little, the way Texas history is talked about might be changing.
We erected last year a monument that's called the Tejana Monument.
And we took a trip to Austin to see it.
So we are steps away from the front entrance at the Capitol in Austin.
The monument shows ordinary scenes from colonial Tejano life. A young woman named Jessica Quiroz walks by. She's shocked to see her Mexican heritage commemorated in such a public way.
Well, I'm surprised it's up here.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is part of Texas history, so it should be up there.
James Crisp is also a Texas historian. We ran into him at the monument.
Tell me what's going on right now. Just tell me.
Yeah, I get very emotional about this.
Because
for so long, these people were silenced, taken out of the history books, treated as if they didn't exist.
So many figures have been forgotten, says Crisp. For example, the Tejano leaders like Juan Seguin, who fought for Texas independence alongside the Anglos. Andres Tijerina says the statue is a statement.
That we're not going to be at the back of the bus. We're going to be at the front of the Capitol. And we're going to tell the Tejano story for all the thousands of little kids who tour that Capitol grounds. They're going to start with the story of the Tejano, because that's where Texas starts.
But it's not where our history lesson ends.
The stars at night are part of Texas.
We've talked about Florida, Texas, and New Mexico. But the other region with a large Spanish colonial influence was, of course, the West Coast. California was ceded to the U.S. by Mexico in 1848. 1 year later, the Gold Rush of 1849 shifted the demographics of the region firmly in favor of Anglo-Americans. But Spanish California does live on, in fiction, as the setting for one of the most enduring American myths of all time. Our producer, Marlon Bishop, picks up the story there.
You've probably never realized it, but the first great American superhero was Latino.
Who wore a mask, wore black clothing, melted into the night, and had a fabulous black steed whose name was Tornado.
That was Sandra Curtis, a Zorro expert. Zorro didn't have superpowers. He couldn't fly or shoot lasers from his eyes, but he was as quick as the wind. He was unbeatable in a sword fight. And, of course, had a way with the ladies.
And what should I say your best
at? Well, I dance all known dances, and I yield to no one in the new world. That's kissing ladies' hands.
Rather than having superpowers, he had super smarts. So he was able to outwit his adversaries rather than overpower them.
Señores?
It's Zorro! I will capture him, comandante!
Most certainly I have not come to surrender, said Señor Zorro. I am on business.
Business? Zorro, or the Fox in English, was invented by Johnston McCulley, a pulp fiction writer from California. These passages come from his first Zorro story, The Curse of Capistrano, published in 1919.
4 days ago, Signore, you brutally beat a native who had won your dislike. The affair happened on the road between here and the mission at San Gabriel.
He was a surly dog and got in my way. How does it concern you, my pretty highwayman?
I am the friend of the oppressed, Señor, and I have come to punish you.
The Zorro story is set in Spanish colonial California. Zorro is the dashing alter ego of the meek Don Diego, son of the wealthiest landowner in the pueblo of Los Angeles.
Oh, please, it's only I. Has something happened?
Zorro's world is full of corrupt colonial officials and cruel military captains. They abuse their power, tormenting indigenous peasants and Catholic friars alike. When night falls, Diego dons his mask and goes on a one-man mission to set things right. But the colonial administration fears Zorro, so they try to turn the public against him by smearing him as a dangerous and murderous bandit.
California is in my hands. I'm accountable to no one, is that clear? No one!
McCulley's story was turned into a hit silent film with Douglas Fairbanks in 1920 and went on to inspire dozens of remakes and TV series. But McCulley didn't pull Zorro out of thin air. The California bandido archetype he resembles had already been floating around for a while, born in the tumult around the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, when Yankees began streaming into California and squatting on Mexican-owned land.
What arose in the popular history, a number of characters who were trying, like Zorro, to defend the vulnerable.
We don't know for sure, but experts believe that Zorro was based on a famous outlaw named Joaquin Murrieta. Murrieta allegedly came to California from Mexico during the gold rush, but was prevented from seeking his fortune by California's foreign miners tax, which was designed to keep Hispanics off the gold fields. Unable to find work, Murrieta terrorized the highways of Northern California. Depending on who you talk to, he was either a hero of Mexican resistance or a common murderer. The only thing is, he might not have been a real person.
There was a popular sort of yellow journalist who started writing in the San Francisco paper about this character, and he probably created Joaquin Murrieta.
As the story goes, the governor put a ransom on Murrieta's head. After he was captured, his literal head was preserved in a bottle of brandy and exhibited around the state. The head eventually made its way to live behind a bar in a San Francisco saloon until it was destroyed in the earthquake of 1906.
It made for great journalism. The question is, was it real?
Another bandido that was undeniably real was Juan Cortina, a South Texas rancher turned fighter. One day in Brownsville, he saw a gringo sheriff giving a beating to one of his former employees. He shot the sheriff and fled. He went on to assemble a ragtag insurgent force that battled with the U.S. Army on and off for years. After being defeated, he spent the rest of his career rustling cattle and dodging the law. Throughout, he framed his actions as revenge for the unjust treatment of Tejanos by the Americans. Historical figures like Cortina provided a model for the Zorro story, but that was just the beginning. Zorro, in turn, went on to serve as a prototype for future superheroes. Think about Batman, another wealthy loner who dons a mask to fight for justice. Batman's creator, Bob Kane, was obsessed with Zorro as a kid growing up in Brooklyn.
So he said that it was very easy for him to take this character who had been in Southern California and put him in this megalopolis, and instead of the cave in the hills of California, he put him in a bat cave, made him a bat instead of a fox, and off he went to defend the oppressed.
But, you know, as time has gone on and the Zorro myth has developed, he's become a sort of epitome of the all-American hero.
Historian Felipe Fernandez Armesto.
And I think that, you know, just about every fictional masked hero in American literature derives from Zorro, you know, Batman, even Superman.
Felipe says you see Zorro's mark in others, the Lone Ranger, Spider-Man, and so on.
They all have the same characteristics. You know, they're all these loners on the outskirts of society who don't need society but who serve it. They all wear a mask to suppress their identity and identify themselves with universal values of right and justice.
But it's worth pointing out that the rakish individualists that Zorro was likely patterned after, they weren't American patriots. In fact, they fought against Americans.
And what a great irony That is, you know, that the great American hero tradition begins with someone who's actually a hero of resistance against the United States.
We often talk about patriotism and loyalty as prime American values. But you wouldn't guess it looking at our superheroes. Compassion for the weak and the will to question and confront authority. Now that's the stuff an all-American superhero is made of.
Producer Marlon Bishop on The Legend of Zorro. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We've been talking about Latino history in the U.S. up through the 1800s. And now, my dear listeners, it's on to the 20th century. People from former Mexican lands such as Texas and California, well, they're known to say, we didn't cross the border. The border crossed us. But after those territories changed hands, Mexicans continued to settle there. They were drawn by economic opportunities in mining and farming, for example. Fast forward to the 1960s. East Los Angeles became the center of the Chicano movement, El Movimiento, what's known as the Mexican-American Civil Rights Struggle. Thousands of Chicanos marched in protests, won reforms, and changed America forever. But only two generations later, that history is being forgotten. California schools don't teach it, and many immigrant parents don't know it. But some people in East LA today are trying to change that. Reporter Valerie Hamilton has our story.
This is the ukulele band at Monterey High, kicking off a performance of student plays. On stage with them, playing backup, Luis Perez, who formed the band Los Lobos in the 1970s, just down the block. No, this is not your ordinary high school drama club, but East LA isn't your ordinary neighborhood. It's the historic heart of the urban Chicano movement, which fought for Mexican-American civil rights in the 1960s and 70s. It's still poor here, now plagued by gangs and crime. But it has a rich history that students are bringing to the stage. The plays are performed by professional actors, but written by students, based on interviews with people who lived East LA's civil rights struggle.
Hey, who are you?
The ghost of Chicano past. I'm here to illuminate you.
I don't know if you have the right person.
Jesus, would a 200-year-old ghost come all the way from Mexico accidentally?
This one tells the story of filmmaker Jesus Treviño, who documented the Chicano student walkouts of 1968.
We want a system where the just rights of the community can be heard.
Yeah, you tell it, Reverend.
In front of Lincoln High School last week.
In front of Lincoln High last week, the crippled and the blind paraded so that you might have eyes to see and courage to stand on your feet and to deal in good faith with the Mexican-American community.
In the 1960s in California, Mexican-Americans were still facing widespread prejudice and discrimination. Mexican-American students were pushed into vocational classes, punished for speaking Spanish, and only about half were graduating. Walkouts by 10,000 students in East LA were the first mass protest action by Mexican-Americans calling themselves Chicanos and demanding social justice.
We are a nation.
Those students set off a larger movement, connecting young Mexican-Americans with their cultural history, music, and art. And that pride was mobilized for political action against the Vietnam War, where Mexican-Americans were dying at higher rates than other soldiers. At the 1970 Chicano Moratorium, a massive anti-war protest in East LA, riots broke out. Police killed three people, including a Mexican-American journalist for the LA Times.
That was the most important date in East LA history, my humble opinion anyway, because that was when the neighborhood woke up.
Wayne Healy is a Chicano mural artist, raised in East LA, a few blocks from where Monterey High School is today. He was in his 20s during the Chicano movement, and he says it changed everything for him. So when he spoke with students last year, he was surprised to find out that they knew next to nothing about what went on.
But which begs the question some more, why, How come you don't know this? Why am I telling you this? Why wasn't it in your history book?
California schools don't teach the Chicano civil rights movement in their standard curriculum.
I only learned about Martin Luther King and Malcolm X when we also had our people for the same cause.
Angel Rodriguez is a student at Monterey, a special high school for kids at risk of dropping out. Last year, he interviewed Healy about the stories behind his murals and wrote a play in which Healy and Mexican revolutionary hero Emiliano Zapata come together to tell East LA kids to stay out of gangs.
The way I see it, they're like, we have a history too, and we want to show our history. We gotta show people who we are, not what they want us to look like.
Los Lobos founder Luis Perez grew up in East LA too. He says it's time for Mexican Americans to own their history.
When you really think about it, we've never written our own story. Someone else has written our story or omitted it altogether.
And that's what the project at Monterey High aims to change. Rose Portillo runs the program and teaches the class called Through the Ages. She says learning East LA's history from people who lived it makes it personal for students.
Once we brought in these people who had participated and helped organize the walkouts and watched them grow 3 inches in height and suddenly become extremely interested in history. Once it became personal, the world changed.
As students connect to the past, she says, they see the present in a new way.
We are of value. Our culture is of value. Our history is of value.
Even as students are discovering East LA's past, they're exploring their own. This year's class wrote plays about how their families came to the neighborhood, stories, histories of today's struggles. And now, Monterey High has recorded its own history right on the schoolyard wall in a mural like the ones they studied from the Chicano movement.
Please rise.
At the unveiling, students showed what they learned from the past. There's an image of striking farm workers and the arch over East LA's main street, a symbol of neighborhood pride. But mostly, the mural is a picture of the present, with lots of blue sky left for future classes to paint on, and for the history that East Los Angeles is still writing.
Valerie Hamilton, reporting that story from Los Angeles. Now let's talk about the history of our very identity as, quote, Hispanics.
Hola, soy Chichi Rodriguez. Todavía hay tiempo para devolver el cuestionario del censo del 80. Hágalo hoy. Es muy importante.
That's legendary golfer Juan Chichi Rodriguez in a 1980s commercial for the Spanish International Network, the channel that would later become Univision. He's inviting Hispanics to submit their census forms for the first time ever, choosing the Hispanic category. Cristina Mora is a sociology professor who studied the history of the term Hispanic. Cristina, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you for having me.
So right now, we essentially take for granted in our country that there is a group of people that are labeled and called Hispanics. But this notion of a large group of people, all of them Spanish-speaking, all under one umbrella, was not the way Hispanics were thought of for many, many years. So what were we before we became Hispanics?
Before these ideas about us coming together were even there, you know, we were all our separate, distinct nationalities. I mean, you know, if we look at America in the 1960s, Mexican Americans almost had a different world and a different set of issues and needs than those that Puerto Ricans might have had in the Northeast.
So who is responsible, if you had to say? Is there an institution? Was there a plan, essentially, in this notion of creating the Hispanic identity?
I think the National Council La Raza was one of the first groups to help lobby the Census Bureau to start thinking about changing the way it classified these groups. And it was also one of the lead organizations taking a role in bringing Puerto Ricans and Mexican Americans together to hammer out a Hispanic agenda.
And what role does the Census Bureau play?
For decades, up until about 1970, they had mainly categorized Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans as simply white. And this was incredibly frustrating for Chicano activists. Whenever they would argue that they needed money for job training programs, they never really had the data to show the federal government. And so as the Bureau considered what kind of category they would create, they started to imagine a broad Hispanic category with subcategories where one could identify themselves as Hispanic, but also as Mexican or Puerto Rican or Cuban, etc.
The other big player was the media. We're going to play another clip from a 1990s Univision commercial, courtesy of their archive.
Participar en el censo es un paso importante para obtener la representación y los servicios que necesita nuestra comunidad hispana.
What role did Univision have in creating the Hispanic / Latino identity?
Over time, as Spanish language television begins to grow, especially throughout the 1980s, they begin to attach sounds, images, and narratives to this idea about what a Hispanic is.
And there were also commercial interests, marketing interests. So what role did marketing and advertising play in creating this Hispanic / Latino identity?
After 1980, the Census Bureau creates some of the first reports on now Hispanics in America. Whereas activist groups might use the income figures to show Washington that Hispanics had higher rates of poverty, for example, Univision executives would use those exact income figures and show General Mills or McDonald's and say, look, this is Hispanic buying power.
So overall, Cristina, would you say that we've gained something from becoming this huge pan-Latino Hispanic category?
When you have a sense of a powerful community, you can create lots of things. You can create organizations that help to reproduce the notion of a community. So, for example, my daughter was born last year, and on her birth certificate, it says that she's Hispanic. When the day comes that I'll enroll her in school, all her school forms will say that she's Hispanic. For all intents and purposes, my daughter might see herself the rest of her life as a Hispanic because it's all around her and it's connected to all kinds of opportunities now.
Your daughter might also just see herself as an American who doesn't have to label herself as a Hispanic because, you know, soon she won't be the quote-unquote minority.
I think, though, as long as Latinos still suffer from many social disadvantages as a group, there'll still be a fight to be had and there'll still be a way of using the category for social justice or civil rights.
Cristina, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria. It's been a pleasure.
Cristina Mora is a sociology professor at UC Berkeley. She's the author of Making Hispanics: How Activists, Bureaucrats, and the Media Constructed a New America. Well, mis queridos listeners, as you know, we like to bring you every week some sabiduría, some words of wisdom to send you off. And for today's show, we're going to bring back historian Felipe Fernandez Armesto, the author of Our America, A Hispanic History of the United States.
So, Professor, when you are in your history classes and you say to your students and your fellow academics, look, the United States is and always has been a Latin American country, and it will be one in the future, what do you say to them, Professor?
Well, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with being Latin. The United States has got, in its own interest, to adjust the way the U.S. person in the street typically thinks about Latin America, because by golly, in the United States, you're going to need Latin America in the future. American century is over. America's no longer the only global superpower. The United States has run out of the resources that made it a great country in the 19th century. The size of the market in the United States is no longer big enough to sustain the kind of wonderful economic growth. You're going to need partnerships with other New World states in order to sustain a buoyant economy. And above all, you're going to need the participation, the integration, the commitment of all the Hispanic people who are going to multiply and continue to grow in the United States in the future. So for all of those reasons, if we want America to remain a great country, and I certainly want that. Well, that's not going to happen unless people change the way they think about their Latino neighbors and see them as equals and embrace them as partners.
Looking to the future, there's a lot of ways that things can go from here. But Laredo, Texas, where we started our show, provides one model of what America's Latino future could look like. Almost everyone in Laredo comes out for the big George Washington's birthday parade, packing the sidewalks. Rocio Riojas and her family are parked along the route, hanging out on the bed of their pickup truck.
Well, we got here yesterday, last night at 6-7 o'clock at night. We had to come prepared this year because last year we couldn't be in the front.
Is it about, what's the important part about celebrating George and Martha Washington for you?
It's not celebrating George Washington itself, but it's just being together as a family.
Marching bands, dance groups, debutantes in colonial gowns all roll by. Almost everyone here watching the parade is of Mexican heritage, but you could hardly imagine a more American scene.
Being a first generation of migrant people, it means being part of something of the American dream.
Her daughter, Ariana, an honor roll student, is the continuation of that dream. What's your dream?
I want to become a hardware tech, a computer hardware tech.
Then every year, near the close of the festival, a moment comes where Mexico and the U.S. come together. Laredo officials meet with their Mexican counterparts on a bridge in the middle of the Rio Grande for a friendship ceremony. It involves two pairs of kids, one from each country.
I am wearing a costume filled with the medals of my great-grandfather, Colonel Thomas Riley, from World War II.
This year, 8-year-old Riley Puig represented America, looking like a little George Washington in his tri-corner hat.
Well, we walked up to the middle of the bridge and exchanged flags and abrazos.
Abrazos, meaning hugs.
I was a little bit nervous, but when I finished the job, I became more confident in myself.
Then a young American is called up to sing a song.
The United States National Anthem will now be sung by Luz Romero of Martin High School.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light?
We've dedicated our show today to reminding listeners that Latinos aren't just a recent footnote to American history. We've been a part of the American story since the beginning. So as we move forward, will our story make it into the history books as well? Or will the idea that the United States is fundamentally white and English-speaking persist? I don't know, but I do know there is some truth to that old cliche about why we need history. If you don't know where you're coming from, how can you possibly know where you're going?